Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And so we start this morning with the question of whether or not it's clear that former Brooklyn Center officer Kim Potter should be facing manslaughter in the second degree charges as were filed against her by the Washington County Attorney's Office yesterday. Manslaughter in the second degree, so up to 10 years, up to $20,000 fine if convicted. And here's how the Minnesota statute for manslaughter in the second degree reads. There's, of course, a number of sort of scenarios that could trigger this charge. A person's culpable negligence whereby the person creates an unreasonable risk and consciously takes chances of causing death or great bodily harm to another. That's number one. Number two, by shooting another with a firearm as a result of negligently believing the other to be a deer or other animal. No. By setting a spring gun, a deadfall, snare, dangerous weapon or device. No. Negligently or intentionally permitting any animal known by the person to have vicious propensities or to have caused great, obviously, no. By committing or attempting to commit a violation of negligent endangerment of a child. No.
No.
So we go to number one. A person's culpable negligence whereby the person creates an unreasonable risk and consciously takes chances of causing death or great bodily harm to another. That's the provision under the statute under which she's being charged, clearly. Culpable negligence creates an unreasonable risk, consciously takes chances of causing death or great bodily harm.
I don't know. I mean, his dad came out, Dante Wright's father came out and said, yeah, this was no accident.
I cannot accept that. I lost my son. He's never coming back. I can't accept that. A mistake, that doesn't even sound right.
Didn't think it sounded right, that she accidentally grabbed her gun instead of her taser.
Well, that's fine, and I'm not really interested in his position. I understand he's a grieving father, so I'll just let him be. But in terms of a legal matter, so then you're going to make the case as a prosecutor that she is an outstanding actress. And in that moment, she yelled, taser, taser, to indemnify herself against her desire to murder Dante Wright? Is that what I'm supposed to believe? Why did she yell, taser, taser? Why did she say, blank, I just shot him? Or blank, I shot him?
Because she made a mistake.
Right. And that's why she's being charged with manslaughter and not murder. So if you want to make out the argument that she intentionally did something, that she intentionally killed Dante Wright, then you have to make out a case for murder. And the prosecutors don't even want to do that. So I've heard the rhetoric from Wright's family and their demagogic attorney, Ben Crump, who we see in these cases every time. And it's, to talk about a reckless disregard for the facts, I, again, family's grieving, so I try not to go there. Let people process this however they need to process it. I get that, but I'm not going to indulge specious arguments that are adopted from the family as some sort of case in a court of law. I mean, that's just absurd. So the other thing that's interesting about this, considering that they were going to place Dante Wright in custody, and they weren't going to do that because he had expired tags, right? They were going to do that because he came up hot as having an outstanding arrest warrant. Well, did they know about that outstanding arrest warrant? I don't know what they knew. But I'm sure the defense will, if they did have knowledge of the nature of the offense for which there was a warrant for Dante Wright's arrest, that could inform how they approached him, even though initially it was perfectly peaceful. It only escalated when he resisted arrest. But then when he resisted arrest, what do I know about Dante Wright potentially that could inform my response to him? Well, it was reported that it was an outstanding warrant for
illegal
gun possession.
But it's more than that. He and a friend back in December of 2019 were arrested and charged with first-degree attempted robbery for allegedly trying to steal $820 from a woman at gunpoint. Okay, so this is not somebody that kids should hold up high. Oh, he's such a good guy.
Here's from the police report. According to the warrant for his arrest, woman, they went to an apartment party, this unidentified woman, him and some friend, at an apartment party. They stay overnight at the apartment. One woman goes out to get money from a bank to pay, I guess, rent for staying over the night at this apartment. And Dante Wright, according to the warrant, give me the effing money. I know you have it. Hey. According to the warrant, the $820 in cash the woman had was tucked into her bra. Wright placed his hand around the victim's neck and choked her while trying to pull the cash from under her bra. Victim was able to get loose from defendant Wright and started to kneel down and scream. Wright then threatened to shoot the woman. Give me the money and we will leave. Give me the money and we will go, the warrant quoted Wright as saying. Wright then tried to choke the victim a second time and tried to take her money. His friend, Wright's friend, was telling her to give Wright the money. His friend, Wright's friend, finally said, let's go, and they got into a white Cadillac and left the scene. They left without cash.
Yeah, and he was later arrested, though, and released on $10,000 bail, but he violated that, Dan, in July when he failed to stay in touch with his court monitor.
$100,000 bail is what I read.
Excuse me, you're right, Mike.
$100,000 stipulations to avoid the victim, not use drugs, have no weapons, revoked in July of last year for failure to not possess a firearm or ammunition. So I say this not because this doesn't have any bearing on the fact that lethal force shouldn't have been used against him in that case, in this instance, and that's sort of agreed upon. I mean, the argument is was an accident, and I think that's the reasonable interpretation of the facts as we have them, including the body cam footage. But when he resisted arrest, what was in the police officer's, plural, all three of them, mind, based on some knowledge they had that there was an outstanding warrant for his arrest? I don't know what they knew, but it's an interesting question.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Because it goes to that first that first case in the statute. A person's culpable negligence whereby the person creates an unreasonable risk, consciously takes chances of causing death and great bodily harm, consciously causes death and great bodily harm, culpable negligence. It would be one thing if he hadn't resisted arrest. It would be one thing if they weren't trying to take him into custody on the basis of an outstanding warrant and that involved violence and that he resisted arrest, and then that's when it escalated and that's when the mistake was made. Now, again, I find the mistaking your gun for your taser inexplicable, but I've also never been in that moment.
It happens so fast, isn't it? I mean, my gosh.
Nick on the northwest side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Nick. Nick, are you there?
You're still. Oh, yes. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, yeah, because you're saying, are you there? Okay. You're the only show I listen in the morning. It's intelligent, well-researched. Listen, I was telling the screener that I don't know if every single police department does this in the country, but many of them, I believe in Chicago, they still do it. You have shift change every, like, month. You work day shift for 1 month, then second shift, then the third shift, which is nighttime, then back to day shift. And that's got to put stress on your body. Some people, I've talked to some cops, say they like it, you know. But I could tell some of them, they're a little bit like wobbly from it once in a while, because it takes, you know, at least a day or two to get adjusted with your mind and body. So I wonder if this person also is one of those where she might have just lost her concentration, and but she has a job to do. She can't just say, well, I'm feeling tired, I got to go. And, you know, maybe something like that has to be investigated also. Give them standard shifts if possible. Some people like working night shift, for example. I don't, but I did like working second shift, you know, for example. Okay. But, so,
well, she was with a trainee. Okay. There was three people there. She was there, another officer and a trainee that they had. So I don't know if that was distracting her. Who knows? But she's been there for 26 years. So,
Leo in Wicker Park.
Yes, hi. I'm sure you're going to wait until you have all the information before you make any judgment. But frankly, prisons are full of people who've done things accidentally but did kill somebody.
Oh, I understand.
Yeah,
I agree.
Lot of drunk drivers. I had a friend in prison for seven years.
You know, and a lot of people get convicted for making a mistake.
Yep.
There's no question. Thanks for the call.
I'm just saying, how long? Well, we don't know how long, or even if she'll be convicted. But what were you saying, Dan? Excuse me.
The question is can you make out a second-degree manslaughter charge against her in this case? Because that's what's been charged. So I'm just trying to address the facts. I mean, you accidentally kill someone, you just say, well, it was an accident, I'm sorry. No, obviously not. This is why we have manslaughter statutes. I'm just saying a second-degree charge here, I think it's a tough case to make out because of the circumstances here. In addition to the larger conversation about Dante Wright and policing, which we'll get to, but I just was focusing specifically on the charging decision by prosecutors. Is it possible that a jury will convict her? Sure. Are people who've negligently done things, accidental, but it was through negligence, culpable negligence, as per statutes regarding manslaughter and other such statutes? Sure, both criminally and civilly. Of course that's true. I'm just trying to assess the quality of the case and if we're overcharging here because of the, you know, political nature of it. That's essentially it. So just going through what the statute says and what the evidence suggests and maybe what the defense will offer.
Well, remember Mohammed Noir? He's the Somalian-American police officer. Minneapolis police officer was responding to an alleged assault in an alley, and he accidentally shot a white woman. He got 12 years in prison, and he was charged with third-degree murder. And so all these protesters like, we want her to go to jail as long as Mohammed Noir did. But the difference is that Mohammed Noir wasn't resisting arrest. She was just walking to the police car to tell him, you know, where the alleged assault happened. And he got out a gun and he shot her point blank and killed her. And that's different. But nobody's recognizing that.
Terry in Rogers Park.
Hey, it's obvious that policewoman Kim Potter's inexperienced. She probably has never even been in a physical altercation before. I think women have no business being in jobs with physical combat.
All right. Thanks for the call,
Terry. I think if they can physically handle it, they could do it. I would never do it.
I don't think... after being an officer for 26 years, her inexperience is going to be a particularly good defense in this case. But, okay. Dennis and Crystal Lake.
Dan, Amy, the gauntlet of this country is down. The media and all the Antifa leftists have put into the mind of the black people that you don't have to listen to authority. You can do harm to authority. You can do harm to a white person, and you are going to walk out that back door because Kim Fox is going to be holding it open for you.
All right, Dennis. I don't think that's exactly the message that's sending, but we'll get to that. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, thanks, Dan and Amy, for taking the call. This thing is all upside down. You got them two girls that killed that Pakistan driver off the hook. You got that... cop in the Capitol who killed that Air Force veteran, off the hook, no issues, no nothing. Here's he's got the warrant out for him and everything, and that hoop-de-doo, big super deal, man, you killed a thing. Why is it so upside down where when it's one way where it's Pakistan or a white woman? And I'm not, racially either way, I'm, you know, you're nothing against black thing, whatever. I'm about fairness. But I'll tell you what, these this leftists are destroying this justice system. When you see where all the focus and all the trouble is with this police woman and everything like that, and then you see what happened. I'm just, that thing makes me sick with January 6th Air Force veteran. No record, yeah. No nothing. Shot dead.
Thanks for the call, Craig. I mean, the Ashley Babbitt thing, you know, one of the things that's interesting about reporting, the reporting yesterday that the officer who shot and killed Ashley Babbitt was is not going to be charged, is they keep referring to him as the officer. In these high-profile police-involved shootings that have a racial component to them, or that a racial component is forced upon them, we always get identification of all the parties, including the police, almost immediately.
Yeah, and then find out how long they've been on the force. Do they have any other infractions? Then we find out about their family members. It's why is this person being treated differently?
The conscious effort to, you know, I mean, he has been named on certain sites I've seen, but the conscious effort by the D.C. press corps to not name the Capitol Police officer is in that shooting is really interesting.
No, and they're protecting him.
What will they say? They'll say the same thing. Well, he's under threat of white supremacy, just like every black person in America.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. You could win $12,000 towards the purchase of a new car or to cover your existing car payments just by doing acts of kindness. Learn more at 560theanswer.com/kindness.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Continuing our conversation about police in the context of the Adam Toledo shooting in Chicago, the Dante Wright shooting in Minnesota. Oh, and the Peyton Ham shooting in Maryland. What's that you say? You haven't heard of that one?
No. Dan, I haven't heard of that one.
Of course you haven't. And who will? And this is the tell. Going back to something, I think it was Dennis from Crystal Lake made before the break, comment he made, that what Black Lives Matter and the race hustlers are telling black Americans, that you can do what you want and this and that. I don't think that's what they're telling them. They're telling them that the police are an existential threat. They're telling them to be afraid. They're telling them they are a victim, and the police are there to victimize them. And so people do irrational things sometimes out of fear, particularly if the fear is misplaced, but nonetheless believable because it's rinsed and repeated 24/7 by the agitprop purveyors that get standing from the D.C. press corps. So you want to do a little case study. It's a terrible case study to have to do. We're talking about dead teenagers here or young adults like Dante Wright. But if you want to understand what's happening, you have to do some examination. Peyton Ham is a 16-year-old kid in Maryland. 9/11 call on Tuesday, just before 1:30 p.m., guy acting suspicious. The callers thought the suspicious guy had a gun. A trooper gets there within minutes, confronts a male in a driveway, and the male appeared to be armed with a gun and a knife. The person in the driveway was in a shooting stance pointing a gun at the trooper, according to a witness. The trooper fired and wounded the male, turns out to be the 16-year-old Peyton Ham. Peyton Ham tried to get up, pulled out his knife. Trooper ordered him to drop the knife before firing again and killing him. Peyton Ham is white. Don't know the race of the officer, but it's the person who's killed that, you know, whose names you're supposed to repeat, right? This is how his parents described him, or family attorney, but, you know, essentially his parents. Incredibly smart, gifted, sweet young man. Honor student attending Leonardstown High School. They compared him to Alex P. Keaton, the Alex P. Keaton character in Family Ties.
Oh, that's you.
Sort of.
Little Dan Proft.
His love of conservative politics always taking center stage at his lively debates at the family dinner table, the statement reads. It turns out that the gun he had was actually an airsoft gun, not a handgun. Now, I mean, could an officer have identified that? I'm not passing judgment here. I'm just setting forth the facts in the case as they've been reported. So watch this play out over the next couple of days if Peyton Ham is a name you only hear on this show. Or if Peyton Ham is included in conversations about policing in America. Or if Peyton Ham is mentioned in the same breath as Adam Toledo and Dante Wright and Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and so on and so forth. And if he's not, given that fact pattern, and if Peyton Ham had been a black 16-year-old versus a white 16-year-old, what I think we can reasonably assume the reaction would be across the nation, that will, I think, provide perhaps a nice case study in support of my contention about what is actually being messaged to black Americans from white champagne socialists in the media and in corporate America and all the other lofty posts they occupy, and the black race hustlers who extort them so that they can enrich themselves and keep this little racket going between the two of them. Meanwhile, of course, the people that are the losers are the people, the law-abiding people who live in these communities, and just the plight of black American families, generally speaking, but particularly poorer black and Latino American families. That's what I think is playing out. Oh, and by the way, another example, or you know, add this to this little work assignment I'm giving. As I mentioned, will Peyton Ham's name be included? Well, we'll see, because CPS recently sent out a missive to parents, didn't it, Amy?
Yeah, they certainly did. A member of our community recently passed away after he was shot by a Chicago police officer on Monday, March 29th. His name was Adam Toledo. And he was a 13-year-old student at Geary Elementary School. As a community, we joined his family and the Geary Elementary School community to grieve his death. Adam was a member of our CPS family. Oh, really? Because you didn't care about your family all year. Maybe he joined a gang because he wasn't in school. Insert of my own. And we've been shaken by the circumstances of his passing. Adam's death, along with the ongoing trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd and the civil unrest in Minnesota after the officer-involved shooting of Dante Wright, are raising many emotions for our students. These events are compounding what has already been a stressful and unprecedented time that they caused. And we remain committed to meeting our students where they are helping them process these complex issues, yada, yada.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So those are the names that you're supposed to remember. And what you're supposed to take away from those names is minorities are victims. Police present an existential threat. They are informed by white supremacy, and they're trying to enforce a racial order and exterminate people, exterminate the other, exterminate people who don't look like them. I mean, that is not bombast. These are the sorts of things that are said and written routinely in established D.C. press corps outlets by public officials.
Yeah, that one came from Janice Jackson. By the way, sincerely, Janice Jackson.
Miss Jackson, if you're nasty. Let's take a couple calls here. Lewis on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I had said something, I think it was Monday, when I had told you about a movie I had saw where the man said that watch the Mexican. If he touches his gun, shoot him. Okay, with that in mind, okay, this is what I think, okay. Miss Kim, whatever her name is, Kim, they didn't have no intentions on killing him. What they were doing was that they was going to match firepower with firepower. What that mean is that when they ran his license plate and he came back, he had an outstanding warrant for a gun violence. Okay, with that in mind, okay, they weren't going to walk up on him and pull a taser out. Okay, so what they had did was, in order for them to meet him, they had to take the safety off their pistol and be ready just in case he touches his gun, we're going to pull our gun out. And that's what had happened, is that when they walked up on him, you know, and he was trying to resist them, it escalated so fast that she didn't have time pull the taser out and take it off, because a taser also has a safety on it. You gotta move the selector on the safety to ready for the taser to be ready for you to fire it, and then you give a warning, you know, taser, so that the other guy will step back and you can shoot the taser. Okay, that's why she was hollering taser, but I think she was hollering taser to let him know, the guy she was trying to arrest, Dante, you know, that they was willing to tase him. But it happened so fast that she wasn't able to get that taser out, so she had to pull a pistol. And the only way you can shoot a pistol, you got to take it off safety. It won't shoot unless you take it off safety. I don't care how fast you is, you have to take it off safety. You have to look at it when you're taking it off safety to make sure that you're putting it on semi. Same thing with a taser. You have to put it on. You have to take it off safety and look at it and make sure it's ready for you to shoot it. And this is where they caught her in her lie, you know. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to say she's trying to cover it up. But if she'd have did just like they did in Jacob Blake, if she'd have just told the truth that she shot him, because it happened so fast, I don't think we'd be going through this right now.
Thanks for the call, Lewis. I don't know where to begin with that, but I don't know. I mean, as I said before Mike Scott's newscast, when we were talking about this a bit earlier, so taser was some sort of feint that she had planned out?
No.
There was no escalation until he resisted arrest. There was no rolling up on him with guns out or tasers out. He was going to be taken into custody. She came up, if you remember seeing the video, right. One officer has got his hands, got Dante Wright's hands behind Wright's back. He's trying to put the handcuffs on. Dante Wright is clearly starting to resist, because then he pulls the handcuffs back. She comes up and places her arm on Dante Wright's right arm, so it's sort of to stabilize him or to indicate to him that another police officer is here, just calm down. And that's when he wheels around, jumps in his car, and that's when everything's unfolds. And it's difficult. It's inexplicable to me how you go taser on your left versus handgun on your right, and you're confused in the moment. It's a terrible mistake that she made, if indeed it was a mistake, and that's what it appears to be.
And I'm sure she feels awful about it. She has her first court appearance today.
But you don't. But you don't see in the body cam video all of this other stuff. By the way, I mean, you can unsafety a pistol without having to like look at it, or it could have been off safety because you're rolling up on somebody that you're going to take into custody. And so you had done that previously. We just don't know those details yet.
And I would like to know how often they're retrained. You know, how often they have to go to the range or be in the simulator. You know.
I don't know how often you have to. I mean, this is a training issue.
I mean, I don't know.
Pulling a taser versus pulling a gun. How often does that happen?
It happened 16 times in the past 20 years, according to NBC News. That's all. I mean, so.
Yeah. So.
Once a year, an officer, and they all don't end in fatal shootings, but it has happened.
Yeah.
To other police officers, and that's, you know, across the country.
Right.
16 in 20 years.
Yeah, so that's not very many with the millions of stops that are done annually. So, again, it's inexplicable to me. It's, I don't know. I don't know that more training to try to, I guess, limit that to zero. And obviously in some years it has been zero. I don't know. I think that's sort of beside the point. It doesn't really provide much context, excuse, explanation for that sort of confusion in that moment. I just it's bizarre to me. And just because it's happened before doesn't make it any less bizarre. Joe in Hoffman Estates.
Good morning. Soon the leftists and the media are not going to have anything to worry about at all as far as police, because I have quite a few friends that are police officers, Chicago, suburb cops, a lot of different people, men, women, black, white. And they said the academies are empty. It's very hard to hire anyone anymore. Who would want to do that job? You'd have to be nuts.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Pete and Racine.
Good morning. Just one comment I wanted to make is it's unfortunate for the entire black community is they are for lack of a better word, are going to come under more scrutiny no matter what they're doing. It's got to cause them angst for the law-abiding person that's black. It's got to be difficult for them all the time with what's going on. And I'm not saying any of this is justified, unjustified, or whatever, but it's just a thought I had. Is it's got to be very difficult to go through life right now if you are a black person. It's sure there's challenges with that.
Yeah, there's challenges for everybody going through life. Thanks for the call, Pete. One of the challenges is because of the incidence of crime.
Oh, do you hear what happened in Wicker Park last night? A mom and her son, 2-year-old, were sitting at a stoplight, and guys in baseball bats came and smashed the driver's window with a baseball bat and yanked her out and the kid out. Thank God they got the kid out and took off in her car. 8 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And
welcome to Chicago.
You have to understand something about policing that Heather McDonald explains in a talk she did for the Center for the American Experiment, our friend John Hinderecker's outfit up there in Minnesota, guy who does powerlineblog.com, we talked to yesterday. But policing is data-driven. So what's the data? Policing is data-driven and sort of makes sense that it is. So what's the data? Well, let's talk about police shootings versus crime stats, not population demographics.
Every year, the police fatally shoot about 1,000 people, the vast majority of whom are threatening the officer or bystanders with deadly force. About 50% of those police fatalities are white, and about 25% are black. The Black Lives Matter folks look at that 25% number and proclaim police bias. Since blacks are about 13% of the population. That is the wrong benchmark, however. If there is one thing you should take away from today's discussion, it is that police activity must be measured against crime, not population ratios. Every article you read, every news story you watch in the mainstream media will compare police activity to a population benchmark. Because that is the only way that the Black Lives Matter narrative can be sustained. Such an analysis ignores the fact that policing today is data-driven. Officers are deployed to where people are most being victimized, and that is in minority neighborhoods. And it is in minority neighborhoods where officers are most likely to interact with armed, violent, and resisting suspects.
Jerry in on I-55.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. My comment is there's one common denominator with all this, and that is the inability to listen to the police commands. If you listen to the police, they would not be shooting at you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And every instance here, they're trying to get away.
That's right.
God forbid we actually listen to the police.
Thanks for the call, Jared. I've said it in all these cases. So much of this could be avoided if you do not resist. I agree. Almost all of it, in fact. Mike and Roscoe.
Hey, Dan. I listen to you guys every morning, I was a little perplexed by your stance with Pate and Tim. I really think if the roles had been reversed and this had been a child of color pointing a weapon at a police officer, you guys would be singing a little bit of a different tune.
What was my tune?
Just his name being included in what's going on, and it's very tragic, but you guys, I think, would be defending the officer's actions a lot more.
I didn't pass. No. Wrong. Absolutely not. Thanks for the call, Mike. Sorry, but absolutely not. Not defending the officer's action. I explicitly said I'm giving the facts in this case as reported. I didn't make any judgment on the officer or Peyton Ham. I said, take this fact pattern and the coverage of what happened. He's a 16-year-old. Adam Toledo's a 13-year-old. Dante Wright's a 20-year-old. And watch how this is covered. Are there any questions asked? And compare that to how the racially charged, purposefully, intentionally racially charged coverage of these police-involved shootings, the other police-involved shootings, are treated. And that will give you some insight into the messaging that's going on, the posture that is being taken, the hypocrisy of it all, the ignorance surrounding these public policy matters surrounding policing. That's what I said. So no, my views actually do not change. They're fact-driven, data-driven, from foundational principles. My views do not change based on race. Mine do not. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and the Associated Press has forced us to come right back to the Dante Wright case in Minneapolis. Dante Wright, slain by police, known as Jokester, young dad. AP story on Dante Wright today. Running concurrent to the information from the Daily Mail that was out yesterday about the exact nature of his previous alleged crimes for which he had an outstanding warrant. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, my God. I mean, we're supposed to honor him as a hero? I don't get it. What he, George Floyd, Adam Toledo, they resisted arrest. This would not have happened if they had just listened to the police officers.
Behind it all, reports the AP, it was the sudden death of a skinny, smiling young man who loved making people laugh and who, after becoming a father in his teens, relished the role of doting young dad, according to his family and friends. Yeah. An older cousin, Mario Greer, said he and Wright loved seeing each other on holidays, especially the 4th of July, when they like to shoot off Roman candles. Mason, another guy who worked as a youth development specialist and mentor at the high school in Minneapolis when Wright was a student there, said he was gregarious and popular. Mr. Mason, he was a charismatic kid. He would joke with you. He was so witty. He was one of those kids that everybody looked up to. Were they still looking up to him? And I know these were just charges that were alleged. His not appearing for his court prevented an adjudication of the matter. Were they still looking up to him? Was this part of his jokester persona, his gregariousness, when, according to the arrest warrant for Dante Wright, he placed his hand around the victim's neck and choked her while trying to pull $820 in cash from under her bra.
Oh, did it twice, yeah.
He then threatened to shoot her if she didn't comply. Then he tried to choke the victim a second time and tried to take her money. And then he failed to the terms of his $100,000 bail in July of 2020. It was revoked for failure to not possess a firearm and ammunition. And I'm not saying that those alleged events should necessarily define the totality of his life either. But I am saying that when those details come out and you have the Associated Press running interference with a hagiographic and stilted view of Dante Wright, there's purpose behind it. You know what the purpose is? Mainly to keep you focused on sentiment and disengage your brain as fully as possible. Mm-hmm. To be ignorant of the underlying facts regarding this particular case or any other particular case in controversy, as well as how policing works in America generally and what the actual data is, I guess, on policing is the best way to say it. The good, the bad, and the ugly. We talked about it yesterday. I have no problem having a conversation about rolling back police's role as revenue agents for the municipality they serve, or the state if they're troopers. No problem have that discussion. They shouldn't be revenue agents. Quotas for tickets and those sorts of things. That's not to say they shouldn't do traffic stops, but they shouldn't. It shouldn't be for the focus of generating revenue from people's back pockets that you can't get through their front pockets, which is what a lot of local governments and state governments do, of course, on everything, including policing. You want to talk about how police are trained in terms of how much fear they should internalize with each traffic stop. There's a lot of talk, defense of traffic stops. These are very dangerous circumstances for police. Well, as we pointed to some studies in the matter, actually, they're not very dangerous circumstances for police, except when the offender is intoxicated or indicating resistance. Then they become dangerous because you have a much greater probability that the individual being detained by police will escalate the situation. That's a different matter. These nuances need to be explored. Heather McDonald, I played a clip from her piece, from her talk, actually, for the Center for the American Experiment before the top of the hour, you know, that you have to look at police shootings in the context of crime stats, not population demographics. That's important. Because that 25% of police shootings, the roughly 1,000 people that are killed each year by police, mostly justified shootings, justified use of lethal force, 50% white, 25% black, and then down the list in terms of population demographics. So yes, it's twice as much as the representation of blacks in the larger population, right? They're 13% of the population, 25% of the shootings. But you have to look at it in the context of crime data. You should also look at this in the context of victimization data. Victimization data, black versus white. Shootings, black versus white. These are other conversations that the press corps and the race racketeers do not want you to focus on.
Here are the victimization data. Nationwide, blacks between the ages of 10 and 43 die of homicide at 13 times the rate of whites, according to the CDC. Wow. In Minnesota, blacks of all ages die of homicide at 12 times the rate of whites. You might think that the Black Lives Matter activists would care about such loss of black life, but you would be wrong. They ignore those black deaths because the victims are killed overwhelmingly not by the police, not by whites, but by other blacks. Here are the criminal offending data. In the 75 largest U.S. counties, which is where most of the population resides, blacks constitute around 60% of all murder and robbery defendants, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, though they are only 15% of the population in those counties. Nationwide, blacks commit homicide at 8 times the rate of whites and Hispanics combined. In Chicago, blacks commit about 80% of all shootings and homicides, though they are less than a third of the population. Whites commit about 2% of all shootings and homicides in Chicago, though they, too, are less than a third of the population.
So what do you say to that data? And put this in the context of the drive for equity, meaning equality of outcomes. 8X, 12X. How do we achieve equity when it comes to the commission of crime? Black Lives Matter, DC Press Corps, Chicago Press Corps. Why does this data matter?
These crime disparities have enormous consequences for police use of force. The biggest determinant of officer behavior is civilian behavior. The greater the chance that officers confront armed and resisting suspects, the more likely they are to escalate their own use of force. And that chance is far higher in black communities.
But instead of confronting this reality, the reality that police have to confront, at least at present, I mean, if you want them to abdicate their public safety role in minority neighborhoods, I guess you can take that position. It seems like a lot of self-appointed spokesmen for minorities are saying that. That's not what, according to survey research, the actual residents of these neighborhoods and communities and cities and states say. But who cares what they say? We have an agenda. We have an ideology to prosecute and inculcate. And this is, by the way, not to play this black-white game in terms of demonization. It's to say, you know, here is the problem you're presented with solving. How do you solve it? What path makes sense? What's the conversation we should be having? Is it the Black Lives Matter conversation? Is it the propagandizing that's done by the D.C. press corps? You think that gets us to a better place? Racial harmony, safer places, minority neighborhoods, predominantly minority neighborhoods in big cities, those become safer because of the AP's propagandizing, because of Black Lives Matter rhetoric, because of the unhinged demagoguery of trial attorneys and other essentially societal predators, civic predators, not so much violent, not so much predators in a violent sense. What do you want to do? You have to gaslight people into believing something is happening that is not happening, so they don't understand what is happening, so you never get to anything resembling intelligence and thoughtful policies with respect to policing. Instead, you get these pieces like from Isaac Bailey over at CNN, who's a professor at Davidson College. He's the same guy who was struggling with his Christianity after Trump. And he writes, he concedes some points, but he can't concede the overarching position. I know that black men are disproportionately harmed and killed by police officers during a variety of encounters. The overwhelming majority of black, while I know that, although what he knows is frankly untrue when properly couched, when you look at the data that's relevant. But I know that black men are disproportionately harmed and killed by police officers during a variety of encounters, but the overwhelming majority of black man-cop interactions don't include violence of any kind from either side. It's simply fact that most black men are not wantonly committing violent crime in a way that should lead them to being perceived as a threat sight unseen, and that most cops aren't hunting black men down like dogs. Given all that, you'd think I'd be singing hosannas about policing in this country and would have no problem calling upon them when my family and I needed help. That's not the case. Why? Because killers and dangerous drug dealers go to prison when they get caught. Dangerous cops often aren't even charged for their bad acts. That makes them more powerful and scarier. Dangerous drug dealers and street criminals are real threats, but a threat in the form of a dangerous cop is existential. And, you know, this is, to me, part of somebody who is living in a time gone by in America that, you know, wants us to pretend that America is 1963 Selma, when police could act with impunity. I think we've seen in more recently that police will be held accountable when they break the law, and should be. Of course they should be. And frankly, there's, at least not that I've seen, not a lot of data, statistical evidence, not anecdotal evidence, statistical evidence to support the claim that in the present day, police are not held accountable for criminal acts against civilians. Jordan and Antioch, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys. You know, I told you, Screener, there's a lot to digest right here. And I think what it comes down to is, you're right, police have been held accountable for more things that they've done within the last, just in the last 5 years. And a lot of that has to do with media pressure and everything else, and I get that. But going back to Lewis, which made me call in because I didn't have enough breadcrumbs to get back in the beginning of his, it comes down to training, right? You want to defund the police, but, and I don't hear this enough from police that call in. I train, I shoot with police, I do classes that are taught by police. And the one thing I get from them is training, 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 right? So when you defund them, what do you take from them? You take equipment and training. Now, it sounds like with this lady, if you listen to the recording, and her own police chief said that the way their setup is on their rigs is taser's weak side, firearm's strong side, right? And she yelled, taser, 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 and then shot him. What that leads me to believe, after taking training from police officers, she did not train enough force on force to use her taser. She went to the lowest level of her training, which is draw the pistol and shoot. And that's for everything. That's for sports, anything. You always resort in a stress situation to your lowest level of training, which for her was draw and shoot. Now, I'm not saying that that's entirely her fault. I think that needs to be looked into, because I don't, after knowing police, a lot of them either have to pay for their own training, or they just don't get the training they need because they don't have the funds, right? Or they don't volunteer because they want to ride out that 20, and they're not all that way. A lot of good cops are in these positions, and they come out on the right side of it because they train their butts off to be good cops and know what to do in that situation.
And, here in Chicago, cops might not have time to train because they just put them back on 12-hour days this morning.
I get that. And that goes back, and that is part of the debate of this whole defund and what is it that you want from your police. Because when you defund them, this is what you get: low training, low expectations, and bad results. The other thing I want to say, and this is in regards to what Lewis was saying, is there was no premeditated. She didn't click off her safety knowing that she was going to shoot this guy. That's dangerous. You shouldn't be talking about that, because 90% of the firearms they carry don't have an actual thumb safety.
Right.
They have a trigger safety. You don't have to mentally take the safety off.
Right.
And the third point I want to make, and goes back to the AP report and all this, all these statistics, is you can take all those statistics, you can take all the cops. Where it starts is this scumbag dad of this kid, unfortunate kid who got shot, who's now on TV looking for a shirt with his kid's picture on it and a GoFundMe page. Because where were you when your kid was beating up somebody for $820? Where were you when he was running with drug dealers? Where were you when he was hanging out with gangbangers committing crimes? Mm. Where were you when he was knocking up some girl becoming a welfare recipient father? Where were you?
Where were they when he didn't show up for his court appearance 10 days before he got shot?
Well, and that's my point. And it goes all the way back. So let's ignore all the stats. Let's ignore all that. This is why I don't go to Chicago with my kid. This is why I don't go to those areas, because those communities are desolate. Those communities are barren of leadership, and the leadership starts with the parents and the fathers. And nobody has the guts to go in front of a camera and say, this kid died, and then show a picture of his dad and say, this kid died because he's a failure. He failed his kid, and that's why he's dead.
Thanks.
That's why he ran from the cops, because he just never taught anything different. Lowest level of training. You're taught to be a criminal, you're going to be a criminal. You're taught and raised to be a good, upstanding citizen, that's what you're going to be. It ticks me off when all we talk about is stats and cops and training them to be more sensitive. When are we going to get some training for people to become fathers and raise their kids to not be scumbags that run from cops when they're on gun charges? Sorry, that's it.
Good call.
Thank you.
Thanks
yeah.
for the call, Jordan. I mean, yeah.
Appreciate the passion. It's
I
true.
Understand.
And we got a Absolutely. Text from a Chicago police officer. Amy and Dan, my 9mm SIG 228 that I've used my entire career does not have a safety on it.
Right.
So,
Nick in Des Moines.
Oh, Des Moines.
Well, I can think of one way in which, and this isn't an excuse at all. I mean, I'm just thinking maybe she put her taser on the belt on one side and her gun on the other. Right. I mean, maybe
well,
when
they,
she
they
went
are
three.
They are on different
They're
sides.
Separate sides.
Yeah.
Left side, weak side is taser.
Yeah. Right side's
gone. No, I understand what I'm saying. Maybe like the way that she always carried it, she loaded it on her belt a different way. That's just an idea.
Oh,
doesn't make
okay.
a difference. It's, you know. But I was also going to say, I feel like there's a self-perpetuating like circle of like just constant fear about. You know, telling black people they need to be eternally afraid of the police and that they're always at risk of dying in an encounter with them. And it's kind of like the Johnson & Johnson shot. Like, I mean, the fear about getting a blood clot when it's 9 and 8 million, it's like...
It's 6 and 7.
People don't understand. Well, there are two more.
Well, but regardless of the shot, 5 and 1 million women get it all the time.
Well, and the other thing is,
that
like,
type
it's,
of
just, it's just crazy to me. Like, it's this constant fear. People don't understand risk, and then
right.
the media just pound down on these things. We just pound people into submission with
right.
no actual thought. And honestly, this is on us. This is on the citizens who don't think. Like, you've got to use your head. Ask yourself a difficult question. How much at risk am I? How dangerous is it for me out there, truly? I mean, does anyone even wonder that to themselves? It doesn't seem like it.
I always thought that they should have PSAs saying, you know, this is what to do when a police... 30-second PSAs. You know, they're doing them for wash your hands and social distance and wear a mask. Do it for that.
Thanks for the call, Nick. What did that CNN technical producer that James Veritas at Project James O'Keefe at Project Veritas got undercover say? Fear sells.
Oh, right? That's right.
Fear sells. Is good for the media, and fear is even better for politicians because fear doesn't just sell, it subordinates. And so in terms of PSAs and the government and they need to do this and police departments need to do that, I think Jordan from Antioch was on the crab, as Sig might say, of the Northwestern and Deadliest Catch when he said about raising. Whatever the narrative is and lionizing victims, lionizing victimization. If CNN wants to do that, if the Associated Press wants to do that, that's fine. You're not doing that in this home. You're not a victim. And you're not going to be a victim because you're going to do these things, and this is how you're going to grow up as a young man. To his point, you know, where are the conversations about that conversation instead of the conversation about being afraid of the police, which is how it's which is what with the conversation that dominates the press corps' coverage of this.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and this happened at Comiskey Park yesterday.
Focusing. 3-2.
Uh-oh, here we go.
Rodon. To third. Moncada. Carlos Rodon.
I have the chills.
Has thrown a no-hitter.
So and, amazing.
And while I'm happy for Carlos Rodon and my White Sox, it's just
no hitter.
I'm just not excited about it anymore.
Oh, even
I just
that?
Can't get excited about it. I can't. Even if he wouldn't have hit the penultimate batter and pitched a perfect game, I can't receive it like I received Mark Burley's perfect game, you know, more than a decade ago.
Now. Oh, I love that.
Or Phil Umbers, for that matter.
And the next day he flew to St. Louis on Southwest, and I was with him on a plane. I couldn't believe it. So humble. Good guy.
Your intersection with greatness.
Yeah. You know, he's really down to earth.
You're like Forrest Gump.
I am.
I just can't enjoy it because of what baseball has now become, like so many of the professional sports leagues, with basically the exception of the PGA. But maybe our friend Ken Blackwell can turn me around on baseball. Ken Blackwell, former Secretary of State for the state of Ohio. He is also a minority shareholder. He has a piece of the Cincinnati Reds. So he has all sorts of... multiplying interests in the future of baseball as a fan included, I'm sure. He joins us now. Ken Blackwell, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's good to be with you both.
All right. So tell me why I shouldn't give up on baseball, or are you selling your shares? Maybe you'll break news here.
No, I'm engaging. You know, Edward R. Murrow once said, a nation of sheep will beget a government of wolves. And so, you know, I always couple that with the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who said, those who are whooped easiest are whooped most often. And so as opposed to selling shares, I step up and I speak up. And, you know, look, my family has a long history with baseball. My uncle, my great uncle, who was the first black American to win an Olympic gold medal in track and field in 1924, where he set the world record in the long jump in the Paris Games. When he came back to Cincinnati, he could only get a job with the Cincinnati Recreation Department, although he had graduated top 10% of his class at the University of Michigan. So he expanded Navajo baseball into the black communities of Cincinnati. He then was one of the founders of the American Negro Baseball League and the founder of the Cincinnati Tigers, who had a very special relationship with the Cincinnati Reds. Cut a long story short, the Castellini family, who was I had a long history with as mayor and as a local official, gave me and some other buddies of mine an opportunity to buy in to the Cincinnati Reds. And so, you know, when the baseball commissioner got over his skis and led baseball into this ridiculous position of moving the All-Star game and being critical of the election reforms in Georgia, I thought I was obligated to speak up and say, not so fast, don't be stuck on stupid, and engage. And that's exactly what we're doing, because, you know, you can't tell the fans of baseball in Georgia or any place else that they are basically racist and Neanderthals because they believe that you should have an election system that first is controlled by at the state and local level, two, has systems in place that will make sure that people are who they claim to be so that we don't have legal ballots being negated by illegal ballots, and next, you know, a tight chain of custody so that we reduce the chances of inefficient interference and fraud. So, look, that's what we're engaged. Baseball fans all over America need to speak up. I'm not a big fan of you know, advocate of boycotts, but I am a realist. There will be economic consequences for Major League Baseball when they tell people that, you know, the requirements of a voter ID to make sure that you are who you say you are and to protect all legal ballots is somehow racist, when if in fact you want to go to pick up tickets at will call at any of these ballparks in Major League Baseball, you have to show a voter ID. I mean, you have to show a photo ID.
I know. And do you think Rob Manfred politicized baseball over a bill he never read? And do you actually think he sat down? Because if you look at Colorado and Georgia, they're pretty much the same. Actually, you have more freedoms in Georgia.
Absolutely. And he, like I said, he got in way over his skis. You know, perhaps some of his buddies that he rubs shoulders with and plays golf at Augusta. maybe they didn't read this, and they're so busy trying to be woke that they made crazy business decisions that impact those folks who actually are the suppliers of capital and dollar at the purchase level to their companies. I mean, shame on Coca-Cola and Delta. To get into their headquarters, what do you need?
An ID.
Photo ID.
Here's the question. The hypocrisy is pretty evident. The question is maybe who sports leagues like baseball serve. Number one, is it the fan base? Is it those consumers? Or is it the corporate backers? I mean, you mentioned a few of them, but hundreds of corporations, including now Starbucks, Amazon, Netflix, have all signed letters signaling their opposition to the Georgia law and any law that the left says is discriminatory. You have the New York Times outing, essentially, here's a list of the big corporations that didn't sign a letter, that are not opposing the Georgia law, and essentially the implication is, and need to. And so is this, you know, sort of the corporate world serving the corporate world, Fortune 500 and baseball and NFL and NBA, in addition to, you know, baseball's relationship with China and Cuba in particular, since they're taking these moral stands?
Oh, absolutely. Again, they are so duplicitous. Let me tell you, what's really at risk here is the framework of our constitutional republic that has made us in 245 years not only the most diverse democracy and in human history, the most prosperous. You know, as Lincoln said, we're not perfect, but we are perfectible. And this is a real headbutting contest as to who's right about this. You know, are we a great nation because of great government, or are we a great government because of good people doing great things together. I think it's the latter. These corporatists, these elitists, you know, think, you know, that they bought into the playbook of the Trilateral Commission and one world government. And so not only do we have, do they believe in a nation without borders, they now believe in voters without borders. You know, and so what's at risk here is our constitutional republic that has defused and disseminated power throughout the 50 states as opposed to having it concentrated in Washington, D.C., in a federal government that the Democrats want to make the property of one party. And as a consequence, will put us on a track of most totalitarian, authoritarian, and big welfare states across the globe.
You know, 15 years ago, you may remember, since you did it, you ran for governor of Ohio. You're the Republican nominee for governor of Ohio. Maybe Ken Blackwell for U.S. Senate in 2022.
That sounds nice, huh?
What do you think?
No, I'm a big fan of making sure that we get the right person who has one. I can no longer tolerate knuckleheads and nonsense.
Yeah.
And so I won't. At 73 yeah. years old, I won't put myself in that situation.
Yeah, that certainly precludes you from running if you can't tolerate.
Yeah, it's good you know what you can handle.
Yeah. Ken Blackwell, former Ohio Secretary of State, and as we were talking about, minority owner of the Cincinnati Reds as well. Always appreciate your comments, Ken. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you both. God bless.
God bless, too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is 60 Seconds of Sanity with Dan Proft. The timer starts now.
The GOP should stop accepting financing from its Fortune 500 adversaries. If former California State Assembly Speaker Jesse Unruh was correct that money is the mother's milk of politics, then it's time for the National Republican Party to wean itself from the milk that comes from the nation's largest corporations. Whether over North Carolina's bathroom law, Georgia's election law, or D.C.'s general profligacy, big business has time and again identified itself as an opponent of equal justice before the law, financial sanity, and even biological reality. The GOP should respond in kind by explicitly and publicly declaring it will neither seek nor accept campaign contributions from Fortune 500 companies' C-suite executives or corporate PACs. Morally and politically, how does the GOP solidify its brand as the party of working people who play by the rules while seeking underwriting from those from whom every rule is subject to a rewrite? The Main Street counter-revolution America needs comes only when the GOP stops giving and taking Wall Street and K Street handouts.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. St. Tony Fauci, in responding to the FDA and CDC decision to pause the J&J vaccine, quote, "I don't think it was pulling the trigger too quickly. We are ruled by the science and not any other consideration."
Oh, really? There's nothing else? Just the science and the data? Not looking at the way the world operated before the vaccine, how this was still not a problem, but 5 in 1 million women get this type of blood clot.
Are we ruled by science and no other consideration? 312-642-5600 Turnkey Dow Pro answer line. 64636 DA Turnkey Dow Pro text line. It's an amazing statement for Tony Fauci in particular to make, because he is the guy who has veered off into everybody else's lane more than anyone else. There's no other consideration. If Tony Fauci was had such tunnel vision, if he was so myopic in his outlook, then why are we asking him when he should open the schools? Why are we asking when it's safe to go to a movie theater or a restaurant or a baseball game?
I know. Did you see that WWFD? What would Fauci do? And he talked like, "Oh, I would never sit in a theater and shove popcorn in my mouth and be around other people. And it was a whole thing, like, we treat him like he's a god.
Your job, you just said, we're ruled by science and not any other consideration. I'll take the we to mean we, the public health professionals, and not we, the American public, although I'm not sure that Tony Fauci sees a difference between the two. But if we, meaning the public health professionals, are ruled by the science and not any other consideration, then why would you weigh in on what people should do? You should present the science as we understand it in the moment and then say, you know, different people have different risk profiles. I'm laying out what we understand the science to be, and then people are going to, policymakers and individual citizens will have to make decisions about their risk tolerances, right? The trade-offs they want to make. In point of fact, Dr. Fauci, if you're ruled by the science and not any other consideration, and you don't make trade-offs, then how did the J&J vaccine get emergency use authorization in the first place? Isn't that a trade-off? There was no notion that it was 100% effective or that it was 100% without the possibility of adverse reactions. So you made a trade-off, right? And saying that, yes, it makes sense that the J&J vaccine, now he didn't do it himself, but part of the community that did, makes sense these vaccines get emergency use authorization. The clinical trials have produced results that suggest that the benefits greatly outweigh the dangers. And for most people, as we understand from the trials, this is a safe and effective way to combat the COVID infection or to prevent the COVID infection, as the case may be. And leave it there. And now you're ruled by science and not any other consideration in the opposite direction. Oh, and by the way, there's something too about science that bears constant repeating. The science is not always accurate in the moment. How much have we learned about COVID and the supposed science? And how long has that taken? Some of it more than a year. Some of it people will never learn, no matter how many times it's presented to them and in no matter what format. But science is ever evolving because it's a search for answers to questions that we have. So it's imprecise or wholly inaccurate oftentimes. So these generic appeals to science is the biggest fraud that's been committed over the last year. Meaning search for truth? Yes. No, but that's not the way it's presented. Science is the truth, definitively. And then when there's a full reversal 3 weeks later, now this is the truth definitively. Rather than providing that context of uncertainty and that knowledge that trade-offs need to be made and risk assessments undertaken. Cindy and Joliet, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Hi, Amy. So the fact that I live in Illinois and know that the governor of Michigan's full name as Gretchen Whitmer, I see her on television the other day, and behind her at her credenza, her background furniture, there's an 8x10 color glossy picture of Dr. Fauci.
It's a pillow of Fauci. Okay. Yeah. He's the number one selling bobblehead doll right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, because he is a bobblehead. And I just can't even. When I saw that, I honestly almost did backflips. And I'm way old, too old to do backflips. But the one thing that Fauci continues to do is, of course, stay out of his correct lane. And I don't even know if medicine is his correct lane anymore. People are handing him documents, read this, say this. And if people are really smart, if they ever have to get a prescription and they get it in original packaging and not like just 30 tablets in an orange bottle, there are pages of contraindications that the pharmaceutical companies put out that, you know, usually the benefit outweighs the risk. That's their kind of balance beam, so to speak, that they stay on for product liability. People never read those. They're like line the bottom of the birdcage with those, you know, and the font is in like a 2 or less. And
Yeah, they wait for the commercials where everybody's in a bathtub talking about how wonderful the drugs are. Yes, exactly.
And you end up on a mountaintop somehow. How did you get a bathtub up there, huh?
Will and
powerful
Skokie.
Stuff.
Hey, how you guys? You got to remember, I mean, this is the big lie that's been perpetrated for God knows how long, that somehow all of the best experts work for the government. No, usually it's people who can't find a job in the real world work for the government, except if they've really been good and they want to do some government service. Fauci is not a researcher. He's not an expert. He's a government administrator. I've checked him. He hasn't written any halfway decent papers in the last 10 years. He's never done hardly any research.
He hasn't seen patients.
I'm sorry?
He hasn't seen patients in 40 years.
Right, right. I mean, I'm a former physicist, and I was trained in the scientific method. And I don't know how much I can tell you it pisses me off when I hear these people talking about science, and they have absolutely no clue what it is. The thing is, next time someone says science, say, what'd you get in calculus? They say, I didn't take calculus. They say, then you don't know anything about science. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call.
Fauci loves his celebrity status. I mean, my God, look at that. And even Dr. Awarde and Dr. Nziki, that people are asking for autographs, taking pictures, throwing out the first pitches at games. It's just work.
I go back to just per Will, a guy who listens to the show, Anthony from Palatine, who's a PhD in the heart sciences, too. He sent this email to us a couple weeks back when we were sort of having a similar conversation. I thought he had just a great distillation of what's happened to science, how it's been polluted by politics, like just about everything else. He wrote, science education has become little more than a computer-generated magic show intermixed with some live tricks. The underlying theory is sometimes taught and always absent the hands-on experience of working with equipment and the errors of measurement. Science is taught as absolute knowledge rather than as a process of theory and measurement and debate. Cindy in Bolingbrook, the other Cindy.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good.
So I have a kid in school. We had an antibody test taken, and they won't let the kid come back to school. They quarantined the kid because they, to follow the science, if you get the vaccine, you get the antibodies. So the science would follow that he already has the antibodies. He should be allowed to go back to school.
And he could have gotten COVID a year ago. I mean, who knows?
We don't know when he got COVID.
Oh, my God.
Never tested positive on a test. And what this is doing to these kids who are not able to go to school is criminal.
I know. And then when they do go back to school, it's almost abusive conditions where they are strapped to a chair. They can't talk to other people during lunch. I mean, it's
they're strapped to a chair like Hannibal Lecter?
No,
How many more
moves?
No, they can't move. You cannot move for 3 hours at a time.
And how many more times can it happen? How many more times can it happen? There's 8-10 weeks left of school.
Yeah.
Is this going to be every 2 weeks?
Well, Cindy, I got to really quickly tell you what happened to me.
Thanks for the call, Cindy.
Somebody anonymously called on April's Fool Day about one of my sons saying that I was with blah, 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 Peyton, Eli, and I have COVID. And they called me and they said, since I didn't call them back, they put him on a list, a non-admittance list for CPS, since I didn't call back. And then I finally called them yesterday. This is the Chicago Health Department. And I said, well, who made the anonymous call? And she said, I can't tell you. And I said, well, did the person have COVID that called? Did you have proof that that person had COVID? She said, no, we can't discuss that. I said, well, no, you're talking about my child who was already, he was already in quarantine since March 28th because someone on their team had it. And I jumped through hoops yesterday and worked for 6 hours to get this straightened out. And they finally straightened it out. But these are the kids, they're putting our children on lists, the red flag list, and they will not let them in school if they pop up. And that's because if you don't call and talk to them, they're just going to pick a date when they think your son could return to the government run school. This is scary stuff, folks. And then when they do call you to talk about your child, they ask what gender was he born? What gender does he identify with now? Is he heterosexual, gay, transitioning? I said, what does that have to do with COVID? That has nothing to do with COVID. Can we please stay focused and on target? And she's like, no, we need to know. But now she said, well, I'll just put down that his sexuality is unknown because he's an adolescent at this time. I said, no, he's heterosexual. Or how about he's none of this is your business? This is scary stuff that is going on, guys.
Sorry about making that April Fool's Day call.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. But I could call today and say, Dan Proft, he was around me and I have COVID. Even though you're not even near me because you're in a different state.
And I couldn't go to CPS. Well, I'll take that risk.
I'm just saying, it's a snitch line, man. This
of course
is
it is.
Scary
it's
stuff.
A snitch culture.
But then they put you on lists and you can't get in to see. They kicked him off football practice the other day. Like, what is going on around here? He doesn't even have the vid. He did the 14 days plus, and I even got him tested for a bonus measure. That's scary, scary things that are happening.
Harry and Aurora.
Oh, hi, Harry.
Hi, good morning. I don't have the time nor the talents, but I'm sure maybe somebody in your audience would. Mm-hmm. And love listening to you, by the way. An idea for our wonderful Dr. Fauci that crossed my mind as a parody would be The Wheel of Fauci. And have a video with the wheel spinning around, and he chooses whatever the path is going to be, the scientific path for the day as far as what we're supposed to follow.
All right. Thanks for the call, Harry. We'll give that to our creative department.
Yeah, we'll give it a spin. Yeah.
Frank in Arlington Heights.
Good morning. Well, as for the creative department, I think I'm going to write a new book, a children's book. It's going to be called Dr. Fauci and the Rats of NIMH. It's going to be about CDC and how incompetent it is and how, you know, they act, everything, and how, you know, Dr. Fauci is a horrible person. He is. I can't stand him. He's polluted so many minds. You know, I do these, I score games sometimes for my high school, and, you know, they have to wear those masks. It's just an atrocity that you have to wear masks while you are playing basketball and soccer.
That's so stupid.
And it's just,
but disgusting. He could have denounced double masking, and he didn't do that. Instead, he embraced it. And now idiots are walking around with two masks and shields.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Appreciate it.
Fauci, he has that power, man.
Fauci in the Center for Control, or Center of Control.
Center of, yeah.
Fauci right. is the Center of Control. Joe in Tinley Park.
Yeah, I was just filling up gasoline this morning, and I was the only one with a glove. So that virus is supposed to last 72 hours?
Mm. It's been debunked. It's not on surfaces.
Oh, okay, good.
Thanks for the call.
But be sure to wash your hands when you're done touching the pump.
Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Thanks for taking my call, Amy and Dan. Let's follow the math. I took a look at this yesterday. If you have the, or get the virus, there's a 1.5% chance of dying. We've had 560,000 people die with a 330 million population. What's the latest number of deaths due to clotting? I think it's eight. Is it eight or nine? And there's 7 million doses. That percentage is 0.0001.
Wow.
So what's your choice? Take the vaccine.
Yeah, thanks for the
thanks
call,
for
Bob.
Doing the math.
And it's less than that in terms of the fatality rate. By the way, also, this out of the UK, Telegraph reporting, almost a quarter of the registered COVID deaths are people who are not dying from the disease, as the government was urged to move faster with a roadmap in light of increasingly positive data. The latest figures from the Office of National Statistics show that 25% of the coronavirus deaths registered are now people who have died with the virus rather than from an infection. So the with from, I mean, now this is relevant just in the interest of truth, but I'm not sure that the frenzy would be any different if the number was 250,000 rather than 550,000. I really don't. I think we reached critical mass in terms of unhinged hysteria at about 10,000, actually. Jeff in Cal City.
Oh, good morning, Dan and Amy. Amy, do you think that what's going on with your children has anything to do with your political leanings and they're just being really sneaky about it and blaming you for COVID and this, that, and everything else?
I try not to be a conspiracy theorist, but yeah, I got the IRS withholding my tax return. I can't get my passport. SEIU filed a grievance against me. And then this happened with everybody on the football team was back. 62 people were back on some day. But my kid was back a week later, and he never even had the vid. So it is some scary stuff we're dealing with, and I have to tell you, I'm exhausted. because yesterday was a long. I've talked to so many attorneys because they're violating my children's civil rights, and you've got contact tracers calling minors. By the way, all the CPS contact tracers are all, guess what, CTU members. I found that out yesterday too.
Wow, amazing! I'm sorry to hear all that. I hope it isn't a conspiracy theory, but I think it is.
Okay, thanks for the call, Jeff. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dana and Amy. Kamala Harris, she's the Vice President of the United States. She convened experts, top men on the job for addressing root causes to the problems that we have at the border. You see, what they've done here nicely, the Biden administration, is they got to Ali Mayorkas, the Department of Homeland Security Secretary. He's taking the border security matter, the southern border issue, because he doesn't have electoral political aspirations. Kamala Harris does, so the last thing she wants to do is wear the jacket for the catastrophe at the border. So she's going to just have Zoom calls with folks from the Northern Triangle countries and talk generically about root causes and probably drop ship some funny money that we print up to those countries and call it a day.
Well, she needs to go to the border. I mean, the other day, she was in Los Angeles, which is an hour and a half away from the border, then flew to Chicago, then back to D.C., so she is traveling.
Yes, that would be wonderful. What we really need is a Kamala Harris photo op at the Mexican Guatemalan border. That's what we're missing here in this conversation. Kamala Harris, listen to this word salad as she's addressing the press with these cutout characters that she terms experts around the table. Listen to this is what she's doing as she's been tasked by Joe Biden, who was previously tasked by President Obama, to get to root causes of Northern Triangle citizens migrating to our southern border.
Hopefully, it's my first trip to the Northern Triangle, stopping in Mexico and then going to Guatemala sometime soon.
Madam Vice President, how do you evaluate success? How do you evaluate success? It's been an intractable problem that we have.
Thank you. Okay.
There are many metrics, and I'm happy to follow up with you after I talk to the experts also. But I agree with you. We have to figure out how we're going to assess our impact. But let me be clear, and everyone who's been working on this, you know, for decades will tell you it will not be obvious overnight. The work we have to do is going to require a commitment that is continuous, that we institutionalize with our partners. And that's the work that I'm prepared to do, which is to begin that process of meaningful work, knowing that we're going to have a long-term strategy, and it will take some time to see the benefits of that work.
Oh, my God.
She hit all of the corporate buzzwords, your favorites, commitment, long-term strategy, meaningful work.
Bingo.
Our partners, institutionalize. Oh, it's wonderful. Those are the metrics by which we're going to measure these things that are unknowable. And here's how you know we will have achieved success. We will tell you because it won't be obvious. There won't be any discernible way to tell that we've been successful. So you'll only know when we tell you we have achieved success. Very helpful. I'm looking forward to the work product, maybe a white paper or something that's produced by these experts that four people in the Western Hemisphere will read. John Nolte, editor-at-large at Breitbart, joins us now. John, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good morning.
Are you a little bit more comforted that they're getting serious about border security after that distillation of the root causes strategy, long-term strategy by one Vice President Harris?
Yeah, like a vaccine, I think what they're going to have to do is go back to what Trump did, because Trump had pretty much fixed the problem. I mean, it was the difference between then and now is striking. Trump solved the border problem. He built the wall, and most brilliantly, he got these other countries to enforce their own borders to keep people out that shouldn't be here. And the only root cause of this catastrophe at the border is Joe Biden. Is Joe Biden saying, come on, we're not going to deport anyone. Come on, you're welcome now. Is saying, we're not going to, you know, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You can come here now.
And that's the root cause of it. So once all that stops, and it's going to have to if they have any chance of winning the 2022 elections, that'll solve the root cause. But Kamala Harris, the biggest problem with Kamala Harris is that she's just stupid.
That is a problem.
And she's very sinister, mm-hmm. but she's a very dumb woman.
Well, wait a second. She's got a law degree. I thought those two things were mutually exclusive.
California. Yeah,
well, she's got all these credentials.
So does Chris Cuomo.
Yeah, no kidding. So here, it's interesting you make the vaccine comparison because the rhetoric is very similar with the vaccinations we get from the CDC director. If you've been vaccinated, it's safe to travel, but we recommend you don't. We don't want you to come here, but we're certainly not right now. But if you do, we're not going to do anything. You know, we'll give you entrance. You'll get a court date and we'll, you know, come back. So, I mean, it's the whole like, hey, this is what we know to be true, but, you know, we're not that serious about it.
Yeah, I guess the left would call it a dog whistle. And, you know, with the virus, of course, you know, America's great anti-vaxxer is Dr. Fauci, who says the same thing the anti-vaxxers do in so many words. He says, number one, the vaccine won't protect you from the virus. And number two, in the case of Johnson & Johnson, the vaccine's dangerous. So they just want to keep us clamped down on us and take away our freedoms for as long as they possibly can. So it's all this gibberish about how it's that basically says it's pointless to get vaccinated and it's probably dangerous. I mean,
but why do they want to keep this going? Why?
Well, the Democrats are fascists. They love to control the population. And my guess is that what they're hoping to do as we go into 2022 is do another spree of vote-by-mail cheating, so that they can justify sending out, and this is what they did in 2000, sending out literally tens of millions of unsolicited ballots. It's probably their only hope of holding on to the House and the Senate. But overall, Democrats love having this power. I mean, Whitmer, imagine how much Whitmer is enjoying being able to lock people down and stick it to the Trump supporters by not allowing them to go voting or do anything. They love this. They love controlling us. And look at how it helped them win the 2020 election.
Now she's worried about her reelection because yesterday she announced that she's not going to have any more major lockdowns. She wants people to be, you know, responsible on their own.
Yeah, and that is them facing the political reality grudgingly facing the political reality, but they're still trying to terrify us into controlling us. And I think they want to keep this going so that they can do what they did in 2020. They want to just mail out tens of millions of unsolicited ballots again. Use you know, even though they may not be locking us down, because continuing to do that will hurt them politically, if they can create a narrative that it's still dangerous, then they can mail out tens of millions of unsolicited ballots, and we all know what happens with those.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's right, and it's particularly the love of lockdowns. In Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, I mean, the only thing he loves more than a Portillo's combo is a lockdown, and you could see it on his face every press conference. He was enjoying the limelight, and so there's the combination of the impulse for control of others and the celebritization of America. Man, these politicians love the limelight. They love being in a square box on CNN, and they love having everybody's attention wrapped around them at these daily briefings.
Yeah, they love putting on the jacket with the emblem and doing the daily briefings and having the media fawn all over them, because they've cracked the code. If you want positive media coverage, take away as many freedoms as possible. But if you do the right thing, like Texas and DeSantis obviously did, along with Maryland and a couple other states that don't get as much attention because they just want to destroy Texas and Florida, you know, if you do the right thing, which they have obviously done, you get killed. So it's all incentivized to strip us of our freedoms, and I honestly think they're trying to bleed it into 2022.
You wrote a good piece for Breitbart.com about rural versus urban and the effort to create heaven on earth that these urban mayors and basically urban center politicians at the state level that we're talking about, what they're doing to the cities as people flee the cities for the suburbs and even the exurbs But rural America is, you know, living out the values that the left says it possesses.
Yeah, what I wanted to point out, and I did it for a couple of reasons. One of the things the media have been very good at doing is blaming problems in Democrat-run cities on America. So we see these riots in these Democrat-run cities, or we see all these hate crimes, like against Asians, which exclusively happen in Democrat-run cities. And we see all the pollution and the urban blight, and that's always presented as an American problem. And I think the media is good at stressing this out. You know, we watch CNN and we watch Fox, and we're like, oh, gosh, things are so bad in this country. And they really are. I mean, if you remove the statistics from Democrat-run cities, Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, New York, etc., this country is unbelievably peaceful, unbelievably racially tolerant, and pretty much clean as far as environmentally. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that the leftists are always saying that they want an America that's free of gun violence, that's clean environmental-wise, and free of racial hatred. And that's rural America, where yeah. Trump voters live. Our air and water and streets are clean. Where we live, we have 10% fewer hate crime allegations than Seattle and Washington, D.C., where 80% of those populations voted for Democrats. Where we live, even though we all own guns, we don't have a gun violence crisis. So we're supposed to be the violent racists who hate the environment, but we live in a clean, peaceful, racially tolerant world out here in rural America. And the numbers, which are in that piece, back that up.
It's a great point. I love the compare contrast. I just don't want you to raise the profile on this too much. It's like not wanting to raise the profile on Florida or Texas, because we don't want the Jacobins to make their way to the countryside, John. You know, don't tell them we're out there.
I don't worry too much about that, because out here they're not going to get anywhere. We're spread out. They want to agitate and they want attention. And they want to find things to agitate over. And when they get out here, and I've seen this happen, I've lived out here for 20 years now, they get bored because, number one, there's no hate crimes. We don't have a homeless crisis. We take care of our homeless in these in rural areas, at least where I live. There's nothing, and they can't get any attention because we just roll their eyes at them. So they get bored, and they just move back to the city where they can get welfare and there's public transportation. So I don't worry too much about it out here. The suburbs need to worry, but out here in rural America, I don't worry about it. It's just too much work to agitate out here. They just aren't going to do it. And we all own guns, and we enforce the law. So if they try anything like this Antifa stuff, our law enforcement is not going to let them out. Our law enforcement's going to put them in jail. And if they try to do something to our homes, we can defend ourselves, and they all know it.
Yeah, no, and the suburbs should be concerned is another point that you just made in passing that needs some emphasis and exclamation points. Yeah, the suburbs should be worried as the out-migration continues from the big cities. John Nolte, editor-at-large, Breitbart.com. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. You too, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook. Or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. One of the things that's actually been encouraging during the pandemic and with respect to lockdowns and associated policies is that you've seen a lot of ordinary Americans present themselves in opposition before their local magistrates or state-level politicians, present themselves in opposition to make the case for, you know, foundational principles of this representative republic in a way that you really haven't seen as much from elected officials, for example. It's heartening on a couple levels. One, it's been a lot of young people, and we've played some of their offerings. And two, it's a reminder that most of these elected officials score much lower on the bravery quotient than ordinary Americans do. And they're not only not your betters, in many cases, they're your lessers, at least intellectually. And so we have another instance. Mackenzie Allen Bettel is a law student, and he recently addressed the Orange County Board of Supervisors on the concept of what is the issue du jour in COVID world, in addition
masks?
To the J&J vaccine, vaccine passports.
Oh, that's right.
Here is Mr. Bettel addressing his lessers.
My name is Mackenzie Allen Bettel. I am 26 years old and native to Orange County. I'm in my last semester of law school, where I specialize in litigation and constitutional law. Nothing about this is constitutional. Nothing about this is American. You, the OC Board of Supervisors, do not have the authority to pass vaccine passport laws. Vaccine passports are unconstitutional under the First Amendment right to freely exercise religion. Many religions teach a core tenet of free will. This includes conscious action. Free will is breached when something is forced. Under Kent v. Dulles, 1953, the right to travel is a part of the liberty of which a citizen cannot be deprived without due process of law, which means in a court of law. Section 1 of the 14th Amendment states in part, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. On top of that, this is not Nazi Germany. Those who do not want to take a COVID vaccine are not evil people. This is the United States of America. If you guys pass this, I say to you, come and take it, and I'll see you in federal court.
Oh, my God. They kind of sound like Chad and JT Party Bros. Remember them?
A little bit more substantive than
I know.
Well,
I mean,
party
more
bros.
Meaning, but the tone of their voice. You know?
Well, you know, you're limited in time with addressing any governmental body, so he had to pack a lot in a short period of time. Pretty good job shepherdizing some of the law on the topic, but didn't have a lot of time to develop the various arguments that he touched upon. Although due process alone, that's in controversy now, thanks to the mayor of Brooklyn Center, who was firing people who believe in due process. So we'll see if that holds up when it comes to vaccine passports in some of these locales as well. But again, nice to see somebody putting a flag down in Orange County, no less. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by Alex Berenson, former New York Times reporter and author of the number one bestseller, Unreported Truths About COVID-19 and Lockdowns, combined parts 1 through 3, death counts, lockdowns, and masks, and also most recently, The Power Couple, a novel. He's a multi-tooled artist. Alex Berenson, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Of course. And by the way, the most recent Unreported Truths, which just came out a couple weeks ago, is about vaccines.
So, about vaccines, right.
I've been very, very focused on vaccines for the last few months, because that's clearly been the where this is going.
Well, before we get to vaccines, let's get ahead of vaccines and to vaccine passports. Then we'll come back to J&J and the like. So vaccine passports, sure. and the arguments that you find compelling and how you see this playing out.
Well, I think the federal government is going to avoid trying to be associated with this, right? There's going to be, even the Biden administration does not want to have its name behind vaccine passports. So what they're going to try to do is encourage, states to do this and companies to do this and schools to do this and colleges to do this. They're going to quasi mandate it without having an official mandate. So you won't have to be vaccinated and you won't have to have proof of being vaccinated. But if you don't, you're going to have to get a swab every 12 minutes if you want to do it.
Or right? Spit in a cup. Yeah.
Really? They've clearly indicated that's what it's going to be. Except in the states like Florida, which have now stood up and said, we're not going to let companies, do this. We're going to try to not let schools do this. This is absurd. Okay. It is absurd. There's no world in which COVID is nearly dangerous enough to mandate this kind of aggressive step by either states or companies. And there's another, I think companies are going to, and schools and sort of non-governmental entities are going to start thinking very carefully about this, especially in the wake of what's happened with J&J, because the vaccine makers are immunized. There is one group that has perfect immunity, and it's not vaccine immunity, it's legal immunity. And that's the vaccine makers. You cannot sue them for anything that happens to you as a result of taking these vaccines. However, if you work for a company that, you know, has effectively forced you to be vaccinated upon threat of termination, or you go to a college that makes you be vaccinated upon threat of suspension or expulsion, and something bad happens to you, it will be interesting to see. I mean, I have to believe the plaintiff's lawyers are going to be looking there. And those cases could be, you know, if you're a 21-year-old who had a stroke and dies, or is, you know, in a vegetative state for the rest of his or her life, it doesn't take too many of those cases to be very expensive.
Yeah.
So,
but even if you get vaccinated, what's the point if we can't go back to normal? I mean, students at University of Illinois have to spit in a cup 3 times a week, and they're still locked in their dorm rooms. And then for graduation this year, each kid gets 15 minutes on the stage to take pictures with their parents and be in a cap and gown, and that's it. Then they fumigate the place and they allow the next student in.
This is so stupid. It's all so stupid, right? Because my position, people say, well, you don't think the vaccines are going to change anything, you know, or Berenson says the vaccines don't work that well. They do work pretty well. Look, it doesn't matter how well they work or don't work. We should be back to normal now.
Right.
With or without everyone being vaccinated, we should have been back to normal almost a year ago. I mean, really a year ago. A year ago at this time, it was clear whom it was affected by COVID, who was affected by COVID, whom COVID affected. It was clear that this was a medical system problem that primarily was going to hurt, you know, people who were very old and very ill, and, you know, and that some of those people were going to die, and there's going to be some strain on hospital systems as a result of that. We know that. We've known that for a while. I mean, we've known that for a year. And that the best thing to do for everyone else would be to get back to work, you know, obviously stay home if you're sick, you know, wash your hands, wear a mask if you're sick and outside, or, you know, sick and inside, and that's it. Okay, that was the playbook for infectious respiratory diseases for, you know, the last 100 years until last March and April. Okay. And somehow we got completely insane and we have not been able to go back. And what's happening with the vaccines is sort of the latest, iteration of this insanity, where on the one hand, everyone has to get a vaccine. And on the other hand, as you just said, the public health authorities want you to believe the vaccines aren't going to do anything to change. You're still going to have to wear a mask. You're still going to have to be scared. What is going on? I don't understand any of it.
And you still can't go to Australia. This is a remarkable position. Health Minister Craig Hunt, he is refusing to guarantee Australia's borders will open even if the whole country has been vaccinated.
What?
They've been shut down for the entire year. 36,000 Australians are trapped overseas. They can't return. He said, and I'm quoting him, "Vaccination alone is no guarantee you can open up. If the whole country were vaccinated, you couldn't just open the borders. We still have to look at a series of different factors, transmission, longevity of vaccine protection, and the global impact, and those are factors with which the world is learning about." So now we have to keep things shut down until the world is vaccinated, and then we see what the impact of those vaccinations are maybe in a couple of years or so.
What do these people want? This is not inhaled anthrax. Okay, this is not Ebola.
Right.
It's somewhat worse than a bad flu. Do they have completely lost the plot? Okay, and the vaccine issue is going to get worse because the J&J and AstraZeneca vaccines have this signature issue. I mean, it's incredibly clear with the AstraZeneca vaccine because that's been used more. It's been used more in Europe. And they seem to have a better surveillance system in Europe, probably because they have, sort of single payer healthcare that enables them to pick up these rare cases more quickly. But you're seeing it here too. And so what this is this very unusual condition where you have clots, serious clots in very dangerous places in your body at the same time as you have very low platelets. And that's, you know, platelets are supposed to. They're supposed to clot your blood. So why would you have low platelets and this clotting issue? Well, there's some very smart doctors and scientists looking at an explanation for this. They think they have it, and it's clearly vaccine related. So
So that's a signature injury.
But
right?
It's also affiliated with birth control pills to have the cerebral thrombosis.
It's not at all. It's not at all. So this is something that vaccine advocates are saying that it's just untrue. It is true that birth control pills cause there's a clotting risk, something called deep vein thrombosis associated with birth control pills. Okay, those clots are not bees. To die from a stroke caused by birth control happens, but it's exceptionally rare, and it doesn't present with this low platelet issue. So this is an effort to pretend that this rare and dangerous condition, which is clearly associated with vaccines, also happens. If 1 in 3,000 women who took birth control pills were dying from this or getting this, you would know it. You would have known it decades ago. Okay, there's no comparison between these two syndromes.
But okay. is that one in 3,000? Is that the incidence of this?
No, I thought it was 1 million.
1 in 3,000 is the birth control figure that's quoted. Right. So that's quoted as an effort to make this thing sound, oh, this is, you know, this happens with birth control even more frequently. Right. No, the number for this looks like, if you look at the European data, which is better, again, for AstraZeneca, it looks like it's at least 1 in 100,000. And about 20% of those cases or more are fatal. So again, you can say, okay, 1 in 100,000 is not that many, on an absolute basis. But understand, these are healthy young people for the most part who are getting this and dying from it. And these people are at very low risk from COVID. But here's the bigger point that I really need to make. This is not the only thing that vaccines. This is not the only way that vaccines might harm you. It's just the only one that is so obvious that it sticks out. So a lot of people who've taken the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine are getting thrombocytopenia, which is low platelets, okay? But people in the population also get that. So it's harder to prove that might be vaccine-related. The reason we're talking about this is because it's so unusual that even people who are vaccine advocates cannot explain it away. It doesn't mean that there aren't lots of other problems happening. It just means they're harder to causally link to the vaccines.
And your position, as you're explaining this, is not to say, your position here, again, is not as an anti-vaxxer. You're just saying, let's be transparent about everything we understand and what we don't know about the vaccines, just as we should have been with respect to COVID, so people make sort of informed risk decisions.
That's correct. And my position is further that because COVID risks are so stratified by age, it may make perfect sense for my mother to get vaccinated, and she has been vaccinated at age 76. But it may make no sense over my dead body. Will my kids be vaccinated because for COVID, that is. They've been vaccinated for everything else, but they will not be vaccinated with these mRNA vaccines because their risk of dying from COVID is so small. Or even spreading COVID. We know this. So that's my point. And this is the same problem. The thing that people say to me who are sort of, anti-lockdown, anti-mask, they say, why are you fighting about the vaccines? The vaccines are going to get us back to normal. The reason I'm fighting about the vaccines is it's the same issue. It's an issue of lying about where the risk really is in terms of COVID, and then using that lie to justify pressing measures on everybody that are not justified for everybody.
It also speaks, and I know you've addressed this before, but in the context of the vaccine controversy, perhaps it bears some revisiting. It also speaks to this idea that, and this is promoted including by free market guys. I see this on some free market websites all the time. You know, the cost-benefit analysis about vaccines or taking vaccines or mandating vaccines is a societal one, not an individual one. Like, you know, as a 16-year-old, the net social benefit of 16-year-olds taking the vaccine is positive, so 16-year-olds should take the vaccine. And whether you forget arguing about that econometric analysis and just the premise, which is that we should be looking at macro societal cost benefit rather than individual cost benefit.
That's right. And you know, why? First of all, the net benefit is probably not positive, but even if it is, that's right. Why do I have to take this risk if I don't think it's a good idea? Right now, maybe I'm thinking of myself as a selfless person and I'm going to take it. And maybe even if there's a 1 in 100,000 chance I'm going to have a stroke and die, that's okay with me because I feel there's some societal benefit to it. Okay. But I should not be forced to do that because you think it's a good idea for me to do it.
Well, you would love it here because our Chicago Teachers Union wants mandated vaccines for high school students who are age eligible and their family members. And that's on their demand list. That's number two on their demand list to go back to school.
They'll do anything not to have to work, won't they?
Yep.
That about sums it up. No more explanation necessary. Yep. Alex Berenson, former New York Times reporter, author of the number one bestseller, Unreported Truths About COVID-19 and Lockdowns, combined parts 1 through 3, death counts, lockdowns, and masks, and then number 4, vaccines, and then also his novel, The Power Couple, which is fiction. So the alpha and the omega of Alex Berenson there.
Is it the Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson story?
Yeah.
The Power Couple.
Alex, thanks so much for joining us. As always, appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, have a good day. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Back when marriage redefinition was the debate, it was those like myself who were arguing, the idea that if you don't support gay marriage, then just don't get gay married. Ha ha ha. That was the response. The point that we made, people like me, was that once you start erasing lines, you're going to find yourself erasing an ever-increasing number of lines till there are no lines left, and you won't be able to redraw any new ones. A New Yorker who wants to marry their own adult offspring is suing to overturn laws barring the incestuous practice, calling it a matter of individual autonomy.
You knew that was going to happen.
Does this mean this sort of sickness is going to pervade society? No, that a lot of people are going to want to marry their child? No. But it means that felonies against incest are going to have to be removed from the books. And it means the further degradation of the culture and the family and our understanding of truth. And so that moved from where it inevitably was going to go, from sexual orientation to sexual identity. And that's what we've been beset with for the last half dozen years, isn't it? To the point we're at now where at Oklahoma University, you don't just have to take a mandatory diversity training course to be admitted, to be able to be on campus and a student this fall. You also have to get the right answers. And if you don't get the right answers, even though this is subjective, you will continue to be prompted with the same question until you give the proper answer, until you've exhausted anything other than the answer that they want. Elizabeth Owen is a graduate student and staff member. In order to participate in this forthcoming school year, required to complete 3 interactive video-based training programs depicting scenarios that a community member might encounter on campus. Because we're all children and we need to be re-educated by the university. The videos depict politically contentious situations. In one, for example, a fictional coworker, Michael, complains, "I'm so tired of all this transgender stuff." Participants then choose from 3 responses. "Wow, that's incredibly intolerant of you." Number 2, "I agree, political correctness can be so tiring." Or number 3, "You seem upset, what's the matter?" Owen selected the second option, political correctness is tiring, which resonated most with her. The video continued and then said, "Right, like who appointed the language police around here?" Then it restarted, forcing her to select the university-approved response of, "You seem upset, what's the matter?" in order to continue on with the next question and get through this Orwellian questionnaire training video, and an emphasis on training, because that's what it's doing. It's cultural training. And so this is similar to the case that we've talked about on this show involving Shawnee State philosophy professor Nicholas Merriweather, who was forced, at least was going to be forced, by the university overlords to address a student by the pronoun the student preferred, rather than addressing them in a way that's reflective of their biological sex and consistent with his understanding of truth as a Christian. And this has become a subject of ongoing litigation that will have great implications for academic freedom and religious freedom on college campuses and in America generally. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Nicholas Merriweather, again, philosophy professor at Shawnee State University, and his legal counsel, Travis Barham, as well. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for
having us.
And I should mention, number one, I hope gentlemen's okay. Number two, Travis Barham is a senior counsel and deputy director of the Center for Academic Freedom at the Alliance for Defending Freedom. So, again, one of these nonprofits or public interest law firms that are representing people whose First Amendment rights are being infringed upon, like Professor Merriweather. So, Professor, why don't you just sort of lay out the case, give us the backstory of the interaction that you had with a student of yours and then how it escalated to this point of litigation?
Okay. Well, it was at the end of a political philosophy class, first day of class, and a male student approached me and demanded that I use feminine pronouns and titles, that I refer to him as a woman, even though I tried to explain that this was something I could not do. The student went to the administration, and the administration then disciplined me for that. I think it's very important to understand that the student remained in the class, performed very well, participated actively in the class all the way to the end, and I offered accommodations to the student so that I would not, you know, be calling him something that he didn't wish to be called. But there was no accommodation that was good enough for the administration, and I was disciplined for it.
So, like, what was an accommodation? Calling him by his first name or something like this?
Using proper nouns with a student.
So he wanted to be she, not he.
The student wanted to be referred to as a woman rather than as a man.
And did the student escalate this beyond his initial conversation with you about how you're to refer to him? Did he bring it to the administration, or did this sort of just get around and
Yes, the student brought it to the administration.
I see.
And initially, the administration had offered for me to do what I had proposed, which was only to use proper nouns, and then changed its mind and insisted that I then, as it were, bow to the ideology. I do think that the pronouns and titles are an important part of this, but it's really about being required to adhere to an ideology that I don't accept. This is a free speech issue. It's a religious freedom issue. So their university was effectively requiring me to endorse this gender identity ideology.
Right. No, that's clear. And you know, we all have a pretty good idea of the sort of pro forma cowardice of university administrators. But I'm more interested in the interaction between you and that student. So he approaches you, and just how did that conversation go, where you explained, you know, your view and why you can't conform with his request, and then he said what?
Well, it's part of the public record that he acted in a very threatening way. He used profanity. He threatened to get me fired on that very first day. Mm-hmm. And I tried to explain to him I can't do that, and so the student was, very threatening and basically threatened to get me fired using profanity.
Then went to
the administration. Yeah,
Travis, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, the situation with the student is one issue, and the student has, I suppose, the ability to express his views however he wishes to do so. The real trouble is when the government starts trying to weigh in on this issue and trying to force people to say things they don't believe. And that's what happened when Shawnee State University decided to get involved and to punish Dr. Merriweather for exercising his freedom of speech. That's where the real troubling scenario is for everyone in the culture. I mean, if the government can force a philosophy professor to endorse ideas that he doesn't believe are true, then it can force any of the rest of us to say things that we don't believe are true. And that's why the victory at the Sixth Circuit on Dr. Merriweather's behalf is such a big deal, not just for professors, but for everyone.
No, I mean, I agree. I'm glad you stated it, that is the big legal issue and the implication outside of this individual case. However, I also think it's instructive to give people some texture here, and you know, those who preach tolerance, and then how that tolerance works when they run into somebody who has a honest disagreement with them. I think that's also instructive.
I agree with you, and it is instructive that Dr. Merriweather went out of his way to accommodate this student, and mm-hmm. even initially in a way that the university was willing to go with until the student continued to complain, and then all of a sudden the university backtracked. And even Dr. Merriweather's effort to treat all students with respect and to accommodate this student wasn't good enough, and they decided to go ahead and punish him.
Right, and it was such an oppressive classroom environment that he continued with the class and did very well in it. Got
yeah.
it.
The
other thing is always interesting in these instances where somebody has been singled out for, you know, for a academic defenestration is your colleagues, Shawnee State colleagues, any professors or administrators even privately express their support or appreciation for your position, or are you just banished from the community now?
Well, there have been faculty that supported me, and there have been faculty that do not support me. But, you know, what I take from that is that the university is to be a marketplace of ideas. It's not supposed to be a one-way street, an assembly line for one type of ideology. So, of course, professors are divided on this issue. And we should be able to have discussions and debates in our classrooms and even among the faculty about this. But when the university steps in, the state effectively, as Travis said, when the state steps in and says, no, there's only one ideology that everybody has to subscribe to, that's where things are really, really going wrong. There have always been debates in higher ed, and there have always been disagreements. There are faculty that agree with me, and there are faculty that don't agree with me. But we need to be able to debate this without having to take a side, without having to endorse one view, and that's where I think things went terribly wrong in my case.
Did any of the students come and support you?
Yes, I've had quite a bit of support from students. And
what
some
about?
That don't support, but again, it's a marketplace of ideas.
No,
I think
that's
very, very vital function of the university in our society, that there is disagreement. But yes,
I'd say interesting.
The students have been supportive. Yeah.
And what's interesting about the ruling from the Sixth Circuit in Dr. Merriweather's favor is it actually benefits all faculty members from all different ideological perspectives. The university was advancing legal arguments that would have stripped all professors of free speech rights. And so when Dr. Merriweather prevailed in the Sixth Circuit, it was not just a victory for him, but it was a victory for everyone.
Well, and so then where does the case stand now? This has been remanded to the lower court?
It's been remanded to the lower court, and we're going to wait and see how the university wants to respond to this. Hopefully we'll be able to resolve the case at this point, because the Sixth Circuit's decision was so clear on so many of the different issues that are at stake in the case. But we'll just have to wait and see if the university is willing to do that, or if they are going to try to pursue this further.
Well, this is what it takes.
I'd like to reiterate,
Travis
said, that this is a great victory for faculty across the political spectrum. This is fantastic.
And this is what it takes, is for people in positions of influence to step up when there's an opportunity to step up, and that's what Professor Nicholas Merriweather has done. Professor Nicholas Merriweather, philosophy professor at Shawnee State University, along with his attorney, Travis Barham, senior counsel and deputy director of the Center for Academic Freedom at Alliance for Defending Freedom. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us, and congratulations on your victory.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and they both joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, as you know, supernumerary penises was not just the name of my college garage band.
Oh, really?
It's also a rare congenital condition. My garage band, it was a Butthole Surfers cover band. We killed with pepper, if you recall. Supernumerary penises, rare congenital condition, once every 5 to 6 million live births, but it happened for the first time in human history to a three-month-old in, well, a child who was born and, right. and was seen, though he's 3 months old, from Iraq. Three penises.
What?
Three penises.
That's a lot of junk in the trunk.
I don't think it's in the
trunk. I mean, it's a lot of junk. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. So what did they do? I mean,
well, first of all, they named him Richard.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Secondly, out of concern that he would grow up to never leave the house, they had the extra two removed.
How do you decide which ones? Like, who stays, who goes?
The extra penises didn't have urethras, so it was relatively easy to make that Sophie's choice. And by the way, it's because this is a medical story, of course.
Yes, of course, yes.
He is a healthy young boy. He's doing very fine, even though he's down two penises.
Okay.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.